Welcome to the Grow My Salon Business podcast, where we focus on the business side of hairdressing. I'm your host, Anthony Whitaker, and I'll be talking to thought leaders in the hairdressing industry, discussing insightful, provocative, and inspiring ideas that matter. So get ready to learn, get ready to be challenged, get ready to be inspired, and most importantly, get ready to grow your salon business. Hey, it's Anthony Whitaker here, and welcome to today's episode of the Grow My Salon Business podcast. As always, it's great to have you here with us today. Now, in case you don't already know, video versions of our podcast are now available on our YouTube channel. So if you want to put faces to the names, then head on over to Grow My Salon Business on YouTube and like and subscribe to the channel. Now, my guest today is hairdresser Richard Ashforth, co-owner of the 10 Seiko salons and academies in several different countries. In today's podcast, we're going to discuss what some of the cultural differences are around how salons operate in different countries and how that can inspire us as our businesses continually evolve. We're also going to talk about Noise, the guerrilla event that Richard hosts in various global locations, and the challenges in training today, and lots more. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Richard.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
No, it's a pleasure. As we were saying before I push the record button, this has been a long time coming. We sort of talked about you coming on my podcast and 2017.
Yes.
So it's, you know, seven years since we finally made it happen. So it's
a lot's happened in those 7 years as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has, hasn't it? Imagine if you could possibly have known what was going to go on in the world in the last 7 years. So who knows what the next 7 years holds. Anyway, let's jump in. Now, I'm always interested in the ever-changing business models and different ways of working in the industry. And I'm intrigued by Seiko because you have partnerships and salons in multiple different countries. So let me ask you this. What do you see in one country? So, you know, I know you're in Canada, you're in France, you're in the UK, you're in Hong Kong, et cetera. So what do you see in one country, whether it's about training or pay or apprenticeships or environmental stuff or technology or products or pricing, anything? What do you see that you look at and you go, wow, we should be doing that in fill in the blank?
I mean, it's a great question to kick off with. I would probably say just off the bat, obviously it's not as a business owner, it's not a natural or probably not a very sensible business strategy to start opening in different countries. You know, the usual route is you would grow in one area, wouldn't you? Maybe open a few salons and then maybe branch out to another city close by, because that makes perfect sense that you can support that business easily and, yeah, it's, and, you know, pull your resources.
And move team members about.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But really the way our business has grown has just been a sort of a very organic way of sort of developing the business. And it's really people that have come to me and said, oh, we love what you're doing. We like your story and we'd like to be a part of it. And that person might be from Scandinavia or they might be from Asia or they might be from North America. And that's really how the business has grown. And it's, you know, it's never really been strategized. We've never really thought about, oh, we really want to be in that market. I mean, of course, we look at markets when they kind of pop up and it's proposed to us and we've not always said yes. But the ones that I think are interesting, that are fun, and they're with people I want to work with, really, because it's, you know, however way you chop this up, it's a people business, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, that's really important, who I'm working with.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm going to ask you more about the business model side of it later, but I was just curious when I saw, you know, Taiwan, Korea, Hong Kong, UK, France. I thought, wow, because I travel a lot, you travel a lot, or I certainly did travel a lot pre-COVID days. And I would often go to different countries and I'd reflect on the way that hairdressing was perceived in those countries, that it was different and the way they did their training was different. And
so
the way they operated, the opening hours, pretty much everything. So I thought when I was doing a bit of research about Seiko, I thought, well, that would be a really interesting question to ask you. Do those salons learn from each other? Not about cut and hand coloring hair, but do they learn from each other different business practices
or do you learn different business practices and sort of see something they do in career and go, wow, that would be an amazing thing to do in our London salon. I mean, I'm really thinking on my feet here, but I'm thinking about how often the Asian countries are really good at massage, for example. They're really good at doing little customer service touches to create a different client experience. Is there anything in those areas that sort of stand out to you?
I think lots of things, and typically they tend to be small things because culturally things are quite fixed, aren't they, I guess. But those small things, like you mentioned, things like head massage is something absolutely that we implement here that we didn't have before we had a sort of an Asian connection, if you like. And I think lots of ways of structuring training, I think that's interchangeable. And I think just different little things we might do for clients in one country that, you know, we'd not thought of in another country, they're easily sort of interchangeable ideas and they're very easy to integrate into your business, aren't they, as well. So definitely on that front, I think, yes. But in terms of what's demanded, you know, culturally, locally, I think they're very unique to particular countries, which makes them fantastic. The fact that, you know, Hong Kong's open till nearly midnight, two nights a week. And in the United States, there's far less holiday taken, for example, which is a big difference. And sometimes quite hard for certainly Europeans to understand, you know, particularly if you're French and you're used to lots of holidays and, you know, not such crazy working hours and things like that seem quite strange. But I think that it's quite interesting that we all get a little flavor of what makes another business tick and how another country operates. Or we're sharing the same profession. So getting an insight in, you know, into the North American business and how the amazing things that North America does in terms of the appetite for education and things like that, as you were mentioning earlier. It's something that maybe is hugely interesting to an Asian community where things are run very differently. You know, there's a lot of self-employment over there, you know, less sort of team-orientated activities and things like that, so.
Okay, so one of the things, you just mentioned North America, for example, and so, you know, in the UK, for example, most trainees do an apprenticeship, whereas in the United States, most of them don't do an apprenticeship, they go to beauty school. So for you, having salons in Canada and the UK and Hong Kong and Denmark, etc., you obviously sort of grapple with different systems that are imposed on you to whatever degree, just by culturally and legally what they do in those countries. So what do you find works best? Do you look at the apprenticeship and think that's what they should have everywhere? Or do you look at like a beauty school model and go, this is what they should have everywhere? Because there's nothing like someone who's got a foot in both camps to be able to make those, you know, judgment calls.
Yeah, I think that there are definite pros and cons to all methods, if I'm really honest with you. And especially now, I find that more relevant now. I think if you'd have asked me that 10 years ago, I would have definitely said, doing a salon apprenticeship, being immersed in a team and learning from the ground up is by far and away the best way to embrace a mindset and a culture. I think now, looking at that 10 years later, I think there's huge benefits to going through a sort of a cosmetology schooling and developing a culture for learning, which I think perhaps has dropped off in the other system, the more familiar system to me anyway, as a salon apprentice, a salon assistant. And I think as I've got older, I think I really do appreciate a commitment to learning. You know, as our apprentices have got older in the business, I'm not sure what it's like generally across the world, but certainly in our business, we found without too much exception that apprentices are getting older. We're not looking to recruit 16-year-olds anymore. Great if we can, but they're few and far between. So just somebody who's coming at it with the right attitude, But I think the thing that will ultimately give you, if you're committed to the longer journey, then that appetite for learning is central to it. So, you know, and I think that's well developed in beauty school environments. I think that's, you certainly learn the joy of learning, you know.
So you don't sort of see that there's one way of doing things that, oh my God, this is how it should be done everywhere. You're sort of saying there's fors and against everywhere, no matter where you are. There's little distinctions in every salon and every sort of cultural thing, but there's nothing that sort of stands out as being this is the way it should be done.
No, I, for me, exactly that. I think it's just, it's about a culture. It's about developing a culture and instilling an attitude in people.
Yeah.
I think if that's done the right way at an early stage, then I think it's great. And it works in every sort of format, if you like, in every location.
Yeah. So in your career path in the UK over the last, 10 years or whatever, been a big shift towards more self-employed. And likewise, big shift in the US as well. Australia, it's sort of starting everywhere. Uh-huh. There seems to be a move towards more independence, more self-employed. Are you seeing that across all the countries that you're in?
Yes. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, whether that's, Europe or Asia or North
America. Asia or North America.
I think for me in North America, it's always been a thing. To a greater or lesser degree. I think we were a little bit behind in that sort of attitude and that approach certainly in Europe. But yes, that's changed, and it brings with it all sorts of challenges, doesn't it? Salon owners out there who are experiencing the very same thing, how to navigate that,
Well, the interesting thing, it's different things that are driving it. In the UK, it's very largely being driven by the impact of the tax, the tax threshold, the VAT threshold. That's what's driving it in this country. It's obviously not being driven by that in the United States. It's more of that sort of entrepreneurial thing. Of that sort of Gen Z, I want freedom and flexibility. So the end result is the same. There is a huge increase in self-employed. In the UK, it's over 64%, something I read recently. In the US, it's probably higher than that again. I'm curious as to, what drives it in different places. A lot of it is a generational thing. It's a Gen Z thing, without a doubt. Obviously, you've got Gen Z all over the world. Let's just go back a little bit and give some sort of overview of Seiko. So there's, about 10 salons, academies. They're in 10 different countries. You're the co-founder with Aldo. He's your business partner, and head office is based in Canada, in Montreal. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So we started in London and Montreal almost simultaneously with a sort of a salon academy in each location. And then we've grown out from there. So Aldo takes care of the business side of things, and I take care of the sort of the creative, the hair part, if you like. Aldo is a hairdresser, though, and he's, arguably more passionate about hair than I am, I think. He loves...
Well, that takes some.
Certainly for him, he's very immersed in hair and hairdressing and the business side of things. So yeah, he loves it.
Well, that's good. That's a good combination. When we talk about education, obviously the last 4 years have been, there's been a bit of upheaval around that. Pre 2020 or 2019, you were hopping on an airplane every 5 minutes and flitting about to different countries. Obviously there was a couple of years there where that couldn't happen. Has that resumed, or has the uptake in online education enabled you to do a lot more of that online? Because as you said a minute ago, it's been rather an unusual way to grow a business, because when you spread around different continents like that, if you're trying to standardize training and it means you flying everywhere and staying in hotels, etc., you can burn through a lot of cash that way. Whereas if you had, 10 salons in one city, you can get everyone together to a central location for education. So you, like me, were sort of forced into online education the last 2 or 3 years. To what degree have you continued that for your own brand?
I think it's a great question. It's something that is pretty significant as a, you know, as an educational brand for us. And yes, pre-COVID, I did spend at minimum 6 months traveling, which was tough, to be fair. That's probably down to 3-4 months now, which is much more manageable. So it's a big tick on that front. We do manage to do more online training. I think it's still, the in-person training is still vital, though. I think to go fully online for me, for our business, is not it's not viable. But to do some aspects of the training, maybe even 50% of it, via online classes, whether that's sort of global classes that everybody can join in together, or whether it's specific to a team and their particular journey that they're on. We do a little bit of both. So for me, it's worked out very nicely in that sense. I think trying to monetize online education is a little bit different and quite difficult these days. I think just in the global sort of marketplace of education, COVID changed things quite a lot in terms of people just giving education away rather than charging for education. So people who made a living from education, such as myself, and now coming up against, not coming up against, that's the wrong sort of phrase, but now working alongside people that can dip in and out of education, who can present things as if when they feel they've got something to offer.
They can
drop that online. I think the biggest challenge for me is, to be honest with you, it's about the detail and the quality in the education. And what I don't particularly like is a 1-minute tutorial on how to do a color or how to do a haircut that people have become very accustomed to consuming and thinking that's where, how they're getting their educational fix. And that include my teams included, you know.
Yeah.
That they might look at things online and go, okay, that's a sectioning pattern. That's where she pulled the hair to. That's
done and dusted.
Done and dusted. I've got a new technique. For me, yes, maybe, and in the very broadest sense, that is a new technique. But all the nuances that go along with a haircut and the and how you make the choices about where the sectioning goes and where how you make the choice about the length and the texture are all very, all that minutia is, for me, that's where the value in education lies, you know.
Yeah. With your team, you know, like any team of people, salon team, you're going to have a big, diverse age range.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about the online education bit here. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I wonder if those young 20-somethings, you know, because they've been born into Gen Z, they've been born with an iPhone in their hand. They're very used to an online world.
Yeah.
Have they adapted better to online learning? Whether we're talking about your team or people that you train for, have they adapted better to it and continue with it more than, say, someone who might be in their, you know, mid-late 30s or whatever? Is that, do you notice any difference there?
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually just about to lead on to that and just say that with our team, I noticed that the younger people within our teams respond very well to those shorter educational kind of messages, but obviously not within a minute, but to try and do them within 10, 15 minutes rather than stretching it out to a 2-hour class.
Yeah.
I think is great for them. And that the feedback I get constantly is that's great. Then they really enjoy those sort of short bursts of education and doing that more frequently rather than a monthly class that lasts 2 hours. Let's do fortnightly classes that last, you know, 30 minutes or whatever it may be, you know.
Yeah, got it.
So, but yeah, I think that certainly the older generation appreciate conversation. They appreciate discussing the, you know, the details a little bit more and getting into the ins and outs of a particular technique and a haircut and the choices you're making along the way. Whereas I think, you know, a younger audience will are much more sort of adept at taking it on face value. And therefore, it's my responsibility to make sure I include those details. I'm not waiting for questions to pop up.
I'm
to bullet point everything to make sure that we're all the touch points are there. So they're walking away, after that 30-minute class with the technique, the information, a fact sheet, you know, things like that, that they can then, have a look over, come back to me if they've got any questions. So it's a different animal, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's a different type of work today than what it was 10 or 20 years ago. But I'm going to come to that at the end. I wanted to ask you about noise. A lot of people won't know what noise is. A lot of people will know what noise is. Perhaps they know what it is, but they don't know that you were the person that was or is behind that noise events. So do you want to just tell us about noise and what's happened to it and, you know, where it's going? Because as you've alluded to, COVID sort of had a big impact on a lot of things, and live events is one of those things that have taken a kick back. So, tell us about noise and where it's come from and where it's going.
Yeah, okay. Well, so 2012, and we're in London, and we are getting set to do the big trade show in London at the Excel Centre in the East End of London. It's called Salon International, so I'm sure many people are aware of that. Really amazing event. And it's something that I grew up with, you know, as a British hairdresser. Big focal point in the calendar. And Seiko are doing some seminars there. We have a seminar room. We're running 4 or 5 seminars over the weekend. We've got a stand on the show floor. We're doing the Alternative Hair Show, which is a big charity event that happens on the Sunday evening of that weekend every year. And I looked at that, and we're super involved in it, but I was a bit deflated and a little bit looking at it with a bit of trepidation. I wasn't feeling very excited by, you know, the amount of models we've got to find and and all the work was ahead. And I sort of felt like I was missing something central to work for me, which is the sort of the excitement of being creative and change. You know, I think that's the fundamental thing. I think I was looking at it and going, oh, here we go again. It's great. And, you know, I will, you know, give it my all, but it would be nice if there was something different. And I think at the time I was moaning to my wife about, oh, here we go. It's all about to start. And, I wish it was different, or I can't remember. It was a long time ago now. But she basically just said to me, you know, why don't you just do something? Don't moan about it. Just go and do something. You know enough people. Go and do something fun then, you know. And at that time, that year, we'd done a collaborative collection. Seiko had done a collaborative collection with some friends of mine called Expression from Spain. Oh, yeah. So they'd not had any platform in the UK at all. And so we invited them over to our stage that we had at Salon International, our seminar room, and we gave them a slot on that. We had a 2-hour seminar or whatever it was, and I gave them half an hour on that. We did half an hour, the collaborative bit. Seiko did an hour, and we gave them half an hour just because they're great guys. They do amazing work, and I thought people should see what they did. So they were already in town. My sort of great friend and mentor, yours probably too, Tim Hartley, is somebody I'm constantly in contact with. And my friend, good friend Peter Gray, who I sort of did my training with at Sassoon many years ago, I knew he was going to be in town. So I just called them up. I knew I got Expression here. I called Tim up and said, I'm thinking of doing this like a sort of a guerrilla show. Are you in? And he went, absolutely. And phoned Peter up. I got the same feedback. And so I decided to do it all by social media, set up a page, didn't tell anybody where the location was until 2 hours before the show. Let everything drip feed, some clues about the general area, et cetera. And that's how we did it. And, the first year I didn't charge any entry, just funded it myself. We'd actually hired a derelict photo studio to do it in. And we bought loads of booze. We were going to try and sort of break even selling booze, you know, and like in sort of the old school rave things where you have to sell a raffle ticket and, you know, for your raffle ticket, every raffle ticket wins a beer or whatever it is, you know. So I couldn't get caught out for selling alcohol illegally. Anyway, an hour before the show, the actual owner of the studio came down, and we realized it had been let by a third party, and he basically is quite a big East End gangster. And he told us we've got 10 minutes to clear everything out of the loading doors. And then he was closing the doors, and whatever was inside, we were never going to see again. And then we had to get off his land, you know, off his property. So yeah. This is like literally, maybe I exaggerate, maybe 2 hours before the show, but not long.
Yeah.
So we had to frantically find somewhere, and we found an outdoor gallery just not too far away, you know, 400 meters down the road. And we went in there, but they said, yes, you can have the space, you know, but you can't sell any alcohol. You know, we've not licensed for it. So it was a free to get in, and you got free drinks. So it was a great night for everybody. An amazing work. The atmosphere was incredible. Outdoors, a little bit rainy. Everybody sat on the floor. We've got two lights and a very mediocre PA. Power cuts every 10 minutes because we were overloading everything. But it was a really amazing experience, you know.
Yeah. And so that was the beginning of it.
Yeah. And that was it. And yeah, I thought, oh, maybe I'll do it again. Maybe I won't. You know, that was fun.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, as it went on, yeah, we did another one the next year, because why not? Because everybody was asking, are we going to do it? Then somebody else, you know, a sort of an educational partner of mine in Russia said, I'd really like to do it in Moscow. Can we do it in Moscow? And then we did it in Tokyo, and then we did it in Taiwan, and then we did it in China, and that's how it started, you know.
So we still same sort of vibe with all of them.
The same model we still do in London every year. Yeah. We don't tell anybody the location. It's still a pop-up in London.
Yeah.
It's not really viable to do it in other countries. They just don't work like that. They won't stand for not knowing where they're going, you know. But for me, I guess the main thing is it's very much like going to a gig rather than going to a hair show. There's no seats. It's quite low production values. You're very close to whoever's doing the hair. It's not dressed up in that sort of corporate sense. You know, there's no branding. So we can have people that work for all different manufacturers, whether they're ambassadors or direct employees or whatever it is. There's no conflict of interest.
Yeah.
And it's just raw creativity. It's, you know, there's no rules.
How many people on average are you getting at these events?
I say in London, we normally get about 350, 400.
Right, okay.
Because it's a last minute thing.
Yeah,
but in Asia, 1,200, 1,500 people.
Right, okay.
So bigger, you know.
Yeah. So money making.
I don't know if it's money making when it gets to that size. For me, I actually prefer it when it's a little bit smaller. If I'm being really honest.
Right. Okay. When you're paying for everyone's drinks.
I don't know anybody. I don't know any event that's ever made any money, to be honest with you. But
right.
But yeah, certainly the goal is always to break even, you know.
Yeah. So, good. Oh, good on you. Yeah. Now, it's good to have, you know, as you've just said, not corporate, guerrilla marketing, you know, something very raw and sort of, you know, I think there's a lot of people in the industry that respond to that.
Yeah. And I think importantly for me, I try and always include a new name. So somebody you would have never known, you'd never heard of them. But they do amazing work, and you should know about them.
Yeah,
and also from a younger person's perspective, perhaps somebody who's a bit of an icon, a bit of a legend that you know has passed you by. It wasn't your generation particularly, but it's important. I feel it's important you should see those people because they're
definitely
that's history. That's
definitely
a legacy, isn't it? You know, and so that's what we're trying to do with it. But most of all, it's about having some fun. It's about throwing the rule book out the window and really everybody, I think the great thing is for me, everybody feels like it's a challenge every time they do a show.
Yeah.
You know, to do something special and do something memorable and, you know, to really bring their sort of their A game to it. So,
Well, they've got a good reputation. I haven't been to one, but they've got a great reputation as being exactly how you've described it. I reached out to you this time. You know, I don't know, a couple of months ago, and I said, listen, we've got to do a podcast together because I saw your latest collection and I only saw it on social media. And I know you said to me before we pushed the record button that it was very much a collaboration, that it wasn't just you. But I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I know that you have a background that is, and you've sort of touched on this already, that you said you like have creative expression in other areas. I know that you started off in a band I think I'm correct in saying that you went to art school. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
so you haven't just come, you know, from secondary school into hairdressing or whatever. You have come to it from an entertainment, a creative sort of background. So you're very diverse in terms of what your input is. And when I looked at not just your latest collection, but another collections you've done over the years, I've always loved them. And there's usually a little twist to them. And this collection that you've done, I mean, I was blown away by it. I thought there was a very strong art element to it. And I often will say that I don't call hairdressers artists, personally. But then I'll usually back that up by saying there's a small amount of people that I'm going to call artists. But as an industry, I'm not going to call every hairdresser an artist because they're just not. But there are some people in this industry who are incredible artists with what they do and what they capture in terms of the images and the hair and stuff they do. And I thought that this collection of yours really did that again. I know it's difficult for people to get what I'm talking about without having seen it, so we will send them towards your Instagram. But talk to us a little bit about that collection before we start to wrap up.
That's collection is called Shape, and really the idea was I work with an academy in Shanghai and help them creatively. They're called Provi, and they have it's a very unique remit they've got, and the guy that sort of organizes it, a guy called Robbie Liu, his passion there is to try and educate Chinese hairdressers into the history of art, of fashion, of music, to give some basis to like sort of more modern hair. Obviously, China's got a very different history to the West's and missed out on a lot over the last sort of 100 years, I think. So in terms of touch points and references, perhaps they're not there, and that's what he's trying to introduce. So it's not just about doing hair, it's about giving things a little bit more context, I guess, or giving fashion a bit more context. So I help him on the hair front. He also has a stylist who helps him on the fashion front, a guy called Victor Goh, who's based in Malaysia, who's a genius, a really incredible makeup artist from Japan called Ryu, and Luke Miyazaki, and then along with Robbie. So he brought us together to do that collection for Provi. And so my bit was the hair. Victor did the clothes. And Luke Ryu did the makeup, obviously. We picked a topic, and we also delivered a lecture on behind it, and et cetera, et cetera. And then at the end of it was like a 3-day journey. We did the shoots, and that was, for me, we were trying to, obviously their hair academy said the hair story is central to it, I guess. But really just trying to sort of ground hair into its, for me, what its origins are, you know, in a modern sense, so Bauhaus related stuff, you know. So it's called Shape because we picked hair shapes, triangular shapes, round shapes, square shapes, and just tried to push them into it. For me, I was just trying to push them into a different sphere. So, you know, whether they were very small and square or very big and, you know, round or whatever they were, you know, with lots of different shapes. And it was a real pleasure to do with ultimate creative freedom, but also with some incredible people who I know and I've worked with for many years on many different projects as well. So I think, it came out well. And
I thought it was brilliant. I mean, I'm glad to see you just mentioned Bauhaus. There was a very strong, to me, Bauhaus look about it. The other thing I just wrote down was Grace Jones. Those album covers in the 80s. What was her partner in crime creatively?
Jean-Paul Goud,
yes, of course. Yeah. There seemed elements of that as well. It was brilliant. It was, your collection, I just thought, was lovely. So I'll make sure that we put the Instagram handles up with this. In fact, tell us what they are now, but I'll also put them in the show notes. Where can people find that on your Instagram?
My Instagram is my name, so @ Richard Ashforth.
Right, you Richard Ashforth. Okay,
yeah, or I'll put Seiko that. Education.
at Seiko Education, right? Mm. I'll make sure I put that in the show notes. Cool. One of the things that we haven't really touched on is salon hair work today. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, I'm a bit older than you, but we have gone through that generation where it's been very much about the haircut. And or we trained in that generation, yeah, where it's very much about the haircut. And for young people today, generalization, but I think pretty true, is it's not so much about the haircut. It's a lot more about the hair color and stuff. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about that in your business, in your view of the world creatively, et cetera. Talk to us about salon hair work and where you see it going, because, yes, we've been in this period of time, arguably for the last 20-odd years, where it's been all about long hair predominantly, but a lot more great color work being done and a lot more dressed hair. Where are your salons sitting in that, and where do you see the future for that sort of stuff?
I mean, it's quite a big question, isn't it? It's a great question.
Yeah, big one.
I think, in a nutshell, I feel quite somewhat concerned for how we are going to move the industry forwards. Because I feel we've got there's just a basic lack of understanding of how to cut hair because there's been so little of it. So I feel we're at the risk of becoming a little bit one dimensional in terms of it being long hair with color, amazing color. As you said, you know, that's fantastic what's happened with color over the last 10 years. But it concerns me a little bit if we don't develop an interest first and foremost in the other side of things, in understanding how to cut hair well, we are going to sell ourselves short, and we're going to become a little bit, we're going to paint ourselves into a corner a little bit with that. So certainly for me, and I mean, in my world, in my business, then it's haircutting's still very central to everything. And I think my mission outside of when I'm educating people outside of Seiko is to try and push that message, to push the foundations of haircutting and the understanding of how to kind of create shape in hair, not just texture and color. So, you know, I know there are others that are trying to tread that path as well. I know I'm not alone, but the overwhelming rise in social media and the platform it gives to really exciting, visually exciting things like color, you know, that are, I'm not going to say they're easier to do, but they're perhaps more accessible things to execute on people.
I was talking about this, I'm not sure if it was on the podcast or to somebody else, but we were talking about this very thing. And I was saying how there's always a trigger for it to change. Sometimes that trigger is someone in the music business.
Yeah.
And I reference people like, you know, Debbie Harry or Madonna, you know, and their huge influence that they had, on hair and fashion. Or sometimes it's a model, you know, and I can remember in the 90s with Linda Evangelista and the rise of the supermodel, but particularly Linda Evangelista, she had a huge impact on hair and short hair looking good. And every time you saw her on the cover of a magazine, different haircut, different color. I mean, she was amazing for the hairdressing industry. So, and then other times it's someone in the movies. And I was discussing this with someone because they were a salon owner, and they said to me that a client came into their salon with a picture of Emma Watson from the Prada campaign. It's the current Prada campaign at the moment. It's all around the world. Yeah. And she's got a little crop. This nice, soft, little croppy haircut. Yeah. Looks beautiful. And this salon owner was saying to me, we had a girl come into the salon with that picture and no one wanted to cut her hair because they didn't know how to. Young hairdressers. And isn't that criminal that's happening, you know? And so that's what I mean. Sometimes it's someone in the movies. Sometimes it's someone in music. Sometimes it's someone, you know, a model that all of a sudden their profile is huge. And it creates this catalyst for change. And that will happen. It's just a matter of how much longer it can go on for.
Yes,
there's an inevitability about it. So keeping those skills alive and kicking will become more important than ever before, just like everything else has within your career and my career, where you see stuff come and go and get reinvented and, you know, revisited in different ways. But
I'd agree to a certain extent, but I guess what concerns me, what worries me is when Emma Watson, her picture comes into the salon and nobody can do it and the client has to leave and the client leaves with long layered hair.
Yeah, yeah.
How does that explode as a trend if nobody's able to do it? It'll just get suppressed. And do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. But
you've got the skills there to execute it and celebrate it and put it on, give it a platform.
Yeah.
And, you know, look at my client, look what I did. Oh, that's great. That's got to be the journey, hasn't it? You know, I'm getting younger people to be on that journey. But as a background to that, I think it's a lot of people's responsibility, whether that's you as a manufacturer. Manufacturers that really take care a lot of education for people now, because education's becoming almost prohibitively expensive for some people because they're self-employed. It's not accessible. They haven't got a salon owner paying for their education.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
As we said before, they're getting snippets of education online. Mm. And then, so they're going for quick fixes, trend-based stuff that they can sell, they can knock out in the salon, they can get their clients instantly excited by small changes, you know. Mm. Absolutely, legitimately the right approach. But underneath that, if we're not investing, and if I'm saying we, or the senior people in the industry and primarily the manufacturers, if we're not investing in teaching people how to cut hair at a very sort of fundamental level to get them excited about that and even giving them choices about that, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A lot of people just feel that as long as they know how to do, you know, some long layering and an amazing blow dry, you know, color's the thing for them. You know, that's what they need to make a great career.
Well, what you've just said, I think, is a podcast in itself, because I don't necessarily agree with you about that's the responsibility of the manufacturer. I think that that young hairdressers that all want to be self-employed and go out on their own, they have to recognize that you wanted to be in business because you're going to keep all the money for yourself. Well, how naive can you possibly be? Running a business, building a salon, training a team requires a lot of money, being constantly invested into making people the best version of themselves that they can be. I know before we started recording, we talked about the role of the manufacturer and how that is changing, just like salons are changing. The role of the manufacturer in the industry is changing. So I think we will keep that one for another discussion.
It's a very big topic
that will open up a huge can of worms. But I've mentioned a few times I was going to point people towards your website, towards Instagram, etc. I'll put those links on our website, growmysalonbusiness.com. They'll be in the show notes for today's podcast. And remember, sharing is caring. So if you've enjoyed this episode, please consider sharing it with a few friends who might also find it useful. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a rating and review on the Apple Podcast app. So to wrap up, Richard, thank you for being on this week's episode of the Grow My Salon Business Podcast.
Anthony, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you'd like to connect with us, you'll find us at growmysalonbusiness.com or on Facebook and Instagram at growmysalonbusiness. And if you enjoyed tuning into our podcast, make sure that you subscribe, like, and share it with your friends. Until next time, this is Anthony Whittaker wishing you continued success.